This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
That's no moon. It's a space station.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia. This is the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we're going through a one-off episode, but there will definitely be more in this series going forward, about the creatures of Star Wars, the original trilogy. As always, this show is broken up into a few different segments. There'll be time codes below, so you can skip ahead to what you're looking for. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an ecologist, a freshwater ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside co-host number one, Adam Harsick, who is a community disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas. We're your movie ecologists. Normally we're joined by co-host number two, Dave, but we're on a very ecology-heavy episode today, so he's not with us. Joining us instead as co-host number two is my son, who will definitely make an appearance at some point throughout. No, not right now. You sit there and you watch Sonic. So apologies to Dave, who has to edit all Eric's various opinions on Star Wars out. Before we get into what we're talking about today, let's just have a recap of the news. The news of which today is, and this is relevant, so don't cut me off too quickly. I had the strangest fucking dream last night. So
I cannot wait to hear this.
Yeah, so we've talked often before about how, you know, in things like Greek mythology and Star Wars being a prime case if you're watching The Mandalorian, people just go in and, like, find these animals who are minding their own business and just murder them for quests or whatever. Think Hercules and the Nemean Lion. Yep. Like I said, if you've been watching The Mandalorian.
Spoilers.
Yes, yeah, spoilers. Not huge spoilers, but still spoilers. Episode 2 has a creature which is... Look, Star Wars has creatures that look like other creatures, but this is straight up an Elasmotherium. It's just that, except exactly. It lays furry eggs, which is gross.
Really gross, and looks very yolky on the inside. It's like, I guess it's a monotreme, a mammal that lays eggs. But at least, to your point about Greek mythology, the Nemean lion was terrorizing the countryside. It was eating everything, so that one's at least fair.
Oh, was it? I thought it was just hanging out.
This one was just sleeping in its little mud pit that looked like a butthole and enjoying itself.
Yeah.
And then we were watching that last night, and my partner was like, that made me sad. It was just sleeping with its baby.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, made me sad too.
It was a real dick move. Anyway, so last night, do you know what an entelodont is?
I probably do.
Those big murderous pigs? The big murder pigs that used to be... I can't remember the era. Anyway, one of them was breaking into a barn. I don't know what I was doing in a barn, but I was in a barn for some reason.
That would be horrifying.
I think there was a barbecue involved. Yeah. Anyway, and I started hacking at it with a hammer, right? This is in the dream. And then I had a moment of clarity in the dream, and I started feeling really bad for murdering this entelodont, because I was like, you know what? That's a prehistoric creature. It's trying to get into the barn. I'd better, you know, stop trying to kill it. So I led it into the barn and it charged me, and that's when I woke up. So, you know, the lesson here is, look, if there's charismatic megafauna, absolutely do your best to, you know, conserve them. But if one's attacking you, probably...
You gotta defend yourself.
Defend yourself.
Today we face the monsters that are at our door and bring the fight to them. Today we are cancelling the apocalypse.
Now, normally at this point in the show, we'd give a quick summary of Star Wars, but if you've never seen Star Wars before...
It's a space fairy tale.
Yeah, what would people need to know to get something out of this episode? I think the main thing is that there's lots of different planets a long fucking way away from each other.
Lots of different planets. There's lots of different animals and plants that you see. I mean, technically, we can assume they're different plants. They filmed it in California, so it's just redwoods. But
yeah,
you can assume there's different... alien plants, but the thing, all you need to really know is, despite this vast world, you really only see a desert planet, an ice planet, and a forest planet. That's about it.
We're just focusing on the original trilogy today. So, Star Wars New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and then Return of the Jedi. I actually think Star Wars, for the most part, has some of the more realistic monsters out there.
I think so.
There's a couple of glaring exceptions, one being that big fucking space worm living in an asteroid.
Yeah, in a vacuum.
We're not going to touch on today, because I think Dave would really love to get into that, and he'll murder us if we steal that one from him. In general, Star Wars does a pretty good job of creating, you know, animals that are realistic. Ecology-wise, anyway. Physiology-wise, in The Mandalorian, again, it's kind of a mixed bag.
You've got the tadpole with legs, the blurg.
Yeah, good name for a species, too, the blurg.
It's so cute. I want
but
one.
But that thing is, yeah, I'm sure David has something to say about the makeup of its legs. That is a recurring theme in Star Wars. George Lucas, back in the late 90s, I think, CGI'd in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he did.
Some of it looks fine, but again, some of it are these massive kind of reptilian things with these tiny little legs. Absolutely minuscule.
Basically dinosaurs.
Until Jurassic Park scientists came along. Using sophisticated techniques, they extract the preserved blood from the mosquito and, bingo, dino DNA.
But anyway, moving on to, you know, is it any good? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. It is what it is. It's.
I rewatched these recently.
It's ridiculous sci-fi, but I haven't watched the originals in a long time. Not since 2015, 2016, Christmas time.
For The Force Awakens? Or?
Yeah, right before Force Awakens came out. A friend of mine that hadn't seen any of them, we went through all of them, starting with the prequels up to the originals, and then we watched The Force Awakens. Those prequels don't hold up, which we're not talking about today, but the originals, still pretty fun.
What do you mean, hold up? Doesn't something have to be good initially to hold up?
I saw them when I was a kid, like 10 to 15 years old.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
So at the time, I was like, this is great. I love this. Look at all these lightsabers. Look at all these spinny fights. You got General Grievous, who's the best. Darth Maul, who's even the better best. But then you go back and watch it, and the writing sucks. Ewan McGregor's wonderful. Hello there. But besides that.
Yeah. But these, the original trilogy, I went through these just last weekend and watched them with my partner, and they're great. Like, they're really just genuinely enjoyable. I don't have the problem that a lot of people seem to have with Return of the Jedi. I don't mind it at all. They're great. Like, if you are worried that these are going to be dated or hokey when you go back, I just go and watch them, because they're fantastic. They're really, really good. Exactly. It's a compelling story, one really good female character, and that's it. Like, yeah.
Is there?
There is Leia, and she's great, but she is only, I think there's three females that really get any screen time in the whole thing. One of them's killed very, very quickly, and one of them makes kind of a cameo in the third film, and that's it.
Mon Mothma?
Mon Mothra?
Mothma.
No, Mothra's mum, yes.
Yes, Mothra's mum.
It's an ambitious crossover, but you know, what? I think they do a pretty good job.
It's 2019, women can have moths now.
And then his aunt, who gets murdered in like...
Horribly.
The first 5 minutes, yeah. Like really quite badly burnt, yeah.
Shit, there are only three in the whole series, aren't there?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I liked, speaking of the Mandalorian real quick, I like that his armorer is a female. That's awesome.
His armorer? Armorer.
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 The blacksmith.
Okay, a blacksmith is a female, yes. His smithy, as it were.
As it should always be, the foundlings are the future. This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Okay, so just before we do get into the ecology of Star Wars, what we're looking at today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Sam Perrin, PERRINNTNU. Adam is at Harsik Adam, HASIK Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematicaanimalia.com, or you can email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to hear about the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you should check out ecologyforthemasses.com. Anyway, moving on to, you know, the ecology of this. Now, one thing we should touch on real quick before we get into what I guess I consider the more interesting stuff is that I think it's hilarious that we've seen, you know, places like there's Hoth, which is the snow planet. There's the desert planet, which is Tatooine.
Yep, or Jakku.
There's the Endor, which is a moon, like a forested moon.
It's a moon of Yavin 4.
And then there is the swamp planet where Yoda lives.
Dagobah.
Now, what's happened, though, which I love, is that I don't know if George Lucas did this, because like I said, I haven't read too much. I've never read any Star Wars fiction or like mythology or anything like that. I've just watched the movies.
Yeah.
Are they actually like entire desert planets and entire swamp planets? Because I feel like we've just seen one scene of them for a movie and people have been like, oh, it's a desert planet.
See, I would think that there would be more to it because realistically, you're not going to have a planet be completely uniform because planets are so big that one part of the planet will be far enough away from the sun than another part that you're going to have a different kind of ecosystem like we have on our planet. The equator's a lot warmer. There's a lot more species. They're a lot more densely packed. They spread out the more and more you get towards the poles. But then you watch the prequels and you have Coruscant, which is a single planet-wide city.
Yeah.
So I think that the common theme here is that George Lucas thinks you can have an entire planet be one entire thing.
Well, the Coruscant thing I can kind of get. Like, that's one entire human construct, right? But, like, having a planet which is just swamp makes no sense whatsoever. Nothing works that way. You would have to have consistent temperature. So whatever your heat source is, right, your planet's surface would have to have equal exposure to that heat source at every time of day and at every time of the year for that to work.
I think it could work because you see, so one of the moons of Jupiter is
Europa.
So Europa is covered in about a 2 kilometer, mile and a half layer of ice.
Yeah.
The thought is that there is liquid water underneath that. I think they actually know that for a fact.
Okay.
And the way that works, the entire moon is this. Well, it's smaller, so it's a bit easier, but it's next to Jupiter, and Jupiter is so fucking massive that its gravity flexes the actual structure of Europa itself. Mm-hmm. And if you think about like a tennis ball or a rubber ball, if you flex it a lot, it kind of heats up because of the friction and the force you're putting on it.
Yeah.
So what's happening with Europa there is it's being flexed by the force of the gravity from Jupiter, and it heats it up.
Okay.
So it can happen, but so maybe Yavin 4 is like a single forest planet, forest moon makes sense. But for a planet like Hoth or Tatooine, I don't know.
But even then, like with Yavin 4, obviously have precipitation on there, right? So how would you have the same level of precipitation across the entire planet? Like, I don't understand how that would work. This is perhaps a little bit out of our wheelhouse because, I mean, we understand the relationship between the forces and what they actually precipitate, but we don't understand the forces themselves too well. Like, I'm no astronomer.
Yeah, we're also not meteorologists.
And now here's Ollie Williams with the weather forecast. Ollie?
It's gonna rain!
Thanks, Ollie.
In any case, let's get on to kind of the fun stuff. Now, colonization. Because I think the thing we have to put down at the start, there's a lot of stuff in the Star Wars lore. So I read a lot of Wikipedia entries.
The best.
That were based on Star Wars A Field Guide. Which is a guide to the wildlife of Star Wars a while ago.
Interesting.
And it suggests that there's species living on different planets that share a common ancestor. Now, there's no way they, given like the way that these things have dispersed, like the distance from each other, without like a certain amount of technology, they can't have done that without human help.
Absolutely not.
And the best example here is this thing of repto mammals,
which you'll have to explain because I still don't get that.
Yeah, so it's like I said, it's a thing I found on the Wikipedia entry, which suggests that the Rancor, so that big thing Luke fights in the pit,
Return of the Jedi,
the Tauntaun, which is the big kangaroo thing,
Empire Strikes Back,
and the Wompat, which same scene, the Yeti kind of creature that attacks him, are all repto mammals, which is just a class of animal that share both reptile and mammalian traits. Which, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that reptiles and mammals do share. But in this case, you've got some members of this class that have scales, some that have fur. All of them seem to lay eggs, including that Elasmotherium creature we were talking about earlier. The suggestion seems to be there that these have evolved from a common species. Look, it could just be descriptive taxonomy. So people have grouped these into different, you know, classes based on the fact that they look similar,
yeah,
which is what a lot of early taxonomy on Earth was as well. Maybe whilst, you know, they've put all their effort into technological advancement, spaceships and the like, they just haven't really given much of a fuck about biology in the Star Wars universe. Like, oh, they all look the same, put them together.
Which seems to make sense because every individual we see in these movies is either a bounty hunter, a somewhat seemingly destined for greatness person, or an innocent victim.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no, like, normal people in this area.
No real... All the scientists seem to be engineers.
Also, not a single scientist that I can think of in any of these movies.
Well, the engineers.
They don't count.
I assume there would be physicians somewhere. Physicists.
We see a physician when they stick Luke in a Bacta tank. And you get to see him in his whitey-tighties.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. But, I like I said, I assume there would be physicists out there as well.
There would have to be. The amount of math you need to fly one of those, a spaceship, is ridiculous.
Yeah. But biologists, perhaps not so much. Although, you know, someone must have told Han Solo that he could just open up the stomach of a Tauntaun and pop Luke in there for a bit.
I mean, he probably saw The Revenant, so he knew he could do it.
And that the Rancor has his trainer. I mean, maybe that guy's an amateur zoologist. And anyway, he didn't look like one. Back onto what we're talking about. I think, like, the timescale of this universe, right? Because it must be enormous. Because, you know, you've got...
It has to be.
Yeah, and you've got species like, I think his name's Bosk, the bounty hunter.
The reptile?
Yeah, so that's a reptilian humanoid, right? So you've got different classes of species from different planets that have evolved into a humanoid form and have become, you know...
We've got fish people, the Mon Calamari.
Yeah. So, I mean, the timescale for this universe must be enormous. And that means that...
That being said, I think we also have to consider that this is a galaxy, not within a universe. Because even a galaxy is so big, you cannot properly imagine it. Even with hyperspeed or hyperlight, whatever you want to call it, travel, it's still going to take you a long time to get from place to place.
When I say universe, I mean kind of, you know, cinematic universe, like the Star Wars universe.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
This galaxy, yeah, because I mean, the title crawl is always in a galaxy far, far away, right? So what I think has happened is that a lot of these planets that you see, where there's just like things that have a common ancestor, I think that's just a fact of humans bringing these species in and them taking over.
Yeah, we've seen it before. That's what happened in North America. The British had an idea of what a civilized species was, and they liked the birds they were used to in England.
Yeah.
So they brought a ton of them over here and just let them go because they missed hearing their native birds, which is so fucking ridiculous.
Everything, like a horse. I mean, these animals could have been brought over. The Tauntauns, for instance, the big kangaroo guys. Perhaps they're a great form of transport. I mean, that's why horses came over to Australia, or horses went over to America, camels, that sort of thing. And Australia is very different because we'd never had horses or anything. We'd had very different kind of species.
You all rode kangaroos, right?
We rode kangaroos, yeah. Very, and, you know, the kangaroo foot means they have a very different impact on the landscape, and horses and other ungulates completely fucked that up. Anyway, point is, a lot of these species could have been brought over for human use, like riding them around. I don't know why anyone would introduce the Wampa.
I feel like there's no way that was introduced, or if it was, it must have been some kind of accident where if these are reptilian mammals, maybe their eggs are similar enough that somebody brought a clutch of Wampa eggs over thinking that they were Tauntaun eggs. Because, I mean, you see this kind of like species being shuffled around by accident all the time. One of the most deadly spiders on the planet is the Brazilian wandering spider. And I feel like there's a lot of different cases where people be opening a pallet of bananas and it's just like, there's a Brazilian wandering spider, which is going to kill you.
In any case, look, there's going to be some sort of introduction here. Maybe the Wampa was brought over to be put in a zoo or something like that. I don't know. It escaped.
Wampa, the deadliest game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Hunting as well. I mean, we brought over foxes for hunting into Australia.
But I feel like at least the Wampa, it makes sense to me that evolved on Hoth. I could see that. That fits the environment. The Tauntaun seems more of like a universal thing, like a horse. Like you can kind of see it in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
And maybe you have variants that maybe have grown up or evolved or been on Hoth for long enough that they've plastically or with evolution become more adapted towards this cold climate.
Yeah.
But the Wampa makes sense. It's like I have in our discussion. I think it kind of suits the analog of a polar bear. It's this large... a solitary predator that's going to be camouflaged very well.
Yeah.
They seem to be intelligent enough to ambush their prey. And at least in the movie, they are very intelligent and have like a trap system so they can like freeze, loop to the ceiling and just save them for later instead of just eating them immediately.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
Like the bipedalism, like, I mean, walking, one of the best things about humans, one of the reasons we survive so well is because we could just follow an animal for days. Like,
we could run them to death.
Yeah. You could just follow, we'd often just find an injured animal, just follow it. And I mean, that's what this thing could be doing. If you've got like, you know, Tauntauns getting injured all the time, this thing could be using ambush. It could also be, following them over a long period. It can use tools. We know that it can string something up. So maybe what you've got here is, an equivalent to, Homo ergaster. An equivalent of an early hominid.
They could be big primates.
Yeah. I don't see any problem with it laying eggs.
I don't know about the biology of monotremes to know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just kind of think of it as weird because... because
Tauntaun got him.
Yeah. I think we think of it as weird because mammals, you know, traditionally don't lay eggs apart from monotremes, which are a very odd type of mammal.
It's 2019, Sam. Mammals can lay eggs if they want to.
I know, but there's only three species that do, so maybe they don't want to. Or maybe they just haven't been given the option, I don't know.
And they're fabulous.
They are fabulous, yeah. I love those long-beaked echidnas. Anyway, the reason I brought up the point about the timescale of this galaxy being so long is that you potentially have a lot of species who are introduced to planets and then just evolved on their own in that area.
Yeah.
You think, like, there's already been adaptations that species like rabbits have made after being in Australia for 200 years. If you give some of these species, you know, I don't, like I said, we don't know how long this timescale is, but if you, you know, think of them as having been on a planet for, I don't know, 200, 300,000 years, there's plenty of plastic adaptations that they could have made, or there's plenty of things that evolution can do. Take the Rancor, for instance. I think the Rancor is maybe something that shares a fairly close common ancestor with the Wampa. And it's come to a desert planet. It's evolved a bit more size. The odd thing is, if you were going to introduce some of these species to these planets, and these planets were potentially barren, because that's the other thing. Like, some of these planets could have been completely barren, no life evolved on them beforehand. Introducing a species there is not going to be as simple as just bringing a species in. You have to bring in a food source. You have to essentially introduce a food web, right?
Yeah, you do. And I think that one thing to keep in mind with that is that whenever you have these systems that don't have much in the way of a lot of species or a well-established food web, is you're going to have to set it all up. And maybe what happened with Hoth is that, let's say Wampas are native to Hoth, and they are there, but they're in very low population numbers because there's not a lot to eat there. It's an ice planet. You don't see a lot of species or a very high number of animals in polar regions. But the humans bring Tauntauns with them. Tauntauns make super easy prey, and as a result, the Wampas tend to hang out around these bases and just feed on people and the Tauntauns, and so their population numbers spike.
That's probably true, yeah. But it is interesting, like, I wonder what a presence of, like, a rebel base in an area like that would do. Because, I mean, there doesn't seem, like, I think it's said within those movies that those planets are pretty empty, right?
They seem to be, and you never see any flora or fauna besides the Wampa and the Tauntaun. That's it.
So, that, I mean, that potentially could be because we've scared them all off. But, I mean, if you've got a planet that's largely uninhabited, I would think that the animals there would be incredibly naive. Like, they would actually be more curious. Like, you would get that spike in, like, activity around them, yeah.
It could be. I know we're talking about the original trilogy, but in the most recent trilogy, The Last Jedi,
yeah.
You see these little, like, crystal cat-looking things that seem to be living in that base because the people have taken off. It's a really good habitat. It's basically a giant cave,
yeah.
And it seems to be safe. And at least in the U.S., we have, surprise, surprise, a ton of military bases all over this country. Because of the very strict rules the military bases have with endangered species, what they can do, what they cannot do with all this land, all of these bases are pretty good hotspots for conserved animals to have their habitat. And whenever they establish, now the Army really can't do anything about it.
Cool.
So they're really good areas for, like, conservation research and for all these endangered animals.
They let ecologists in and that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
nice.
we have a permit to a base actually here in Arkansas that we go to.
Cool. All right. Well, look, I think we've covered that pretty comprehensively. I think it's a really interesting subject, though. And I also, like I said, I really think that concept of, like, I've always wondered how you would go about introducing a complete food web to a planet.
I think it would have to be what you see actually, like, with island establishment, like in the Pacific, whenever a volcano rises up and forms a stable island, mm-hmm. You see that first and foremost, dirt starts to accumulate on the island.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you get a couple seeds, a couple plants, and one of the first organisms always is spiders.
Yeah.
Because they disperse so well.
Okay, yeah.
So you'd have to start from the bottom up. You can't just throw a top predator in an ecosystem and expect it to survive.
Yeah.
You need the base of the food web before you can go any higher. So you'd have...
Yeah.
You know, you have your autotrophs, your plants, things that can make their own food. Then you have some primary consumers, things that eat the plants. Then you have some meso and apex consumers, things that eat the things that eat the plants.
And you'd have to also, like, you could design, essentially, an ecosystem. It'd be a fascinating job, I think. Anyway, the last thing that we wanted to touch on, because it's really interesting, is the Sarlacc.
Oh my god, that's fucking the stupidest thing ever.
People have probably seen that meme. In his belly, the Sarlacc, this is, you will find a new definition of pain and suffering as you are slowly digested over 1,000 years. And...
No.
No. It's not how it's going to work. Like, you can't live in something's belly for 1,000 years. It's not going to work.
I think this meme is worth repeating for someone who's never seen it, because I actually haven't seen this myself.
Oh, really?
So like Sam was saying, 3PO says, and this is from the movie, "In his belly you will find a new definition of pain and suffering as you were slowly digested over 1,000 years. To which Luke, in the meme, responds, "Tell him that sounds stupid as fuck, and that we would die of starvation or dehydration in less than a month. Tell him I said he sounds like an idiot who was clueless about biology." Yeah. Tell him, 3PO. Tell him he is stupid as fuck. In those exact words, 3PO.
I mean, you can...
And it's accurate.
You can potentially keep something alive for a long time. Like, you know, like spiders do. Keeping their prey alive and, you know, slowly dissolving them, that sort of thing.
I don't know if they keep them alive. It just takes a while for their venom to work.
I thought they were alive whilst they were being dissolved a lot of the time.
Sometimes. I mean, it takes a while, but I can't think of a single organism that purposefully keeps something alive to eat it for a long
time. Yeah, you would have to be, like, providing energy to that organism.
Exactly.
Fighting off all its defenses for it.
Keeping an organism inside of you alive so that you can feed off of it is a net loss, because you're providing, and like Sam said, you have to feed it to keep it alive so you can feed off of it. It doesn't work. That's not how biology works. You can't produce something and then get energy from it and keep producing it.
I think, look, it's probably just metaphorical. Jabba's just, you know, said that to get people fucking terrified, but...
Jabba seems to be an idiot.
His physiology. Don't know what's going on there. Don't know how that evolved on any planet that was like, yeah, this works. This is efficient. I can outrun predators. What was his defense mechanism when that species wasn't that smart?
There couldn't have been one. Yeah. I feel like... In all of the books and all the games I've played, the Hutts are always these enormous fat slugs. They were never like trim, athletic, snake-looking dudes.
I don't know. That always boggled my mind. The reptilian humanoids, whatever, Jabba the Hutt, nah. Nah, because there had to be some point at which they were not like intelligent beings when they evolved on their home planet. And they would have just had chunks being torn out of him. Anyway.
I mean, he looks like he has skin like a rhinoceros.
But Leia strangles him, so no.
He must weigh at least a ton. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it doesn't make any. But anyway, but the Sarlacc itself, like, so a lot of the sort of stuff that I think we're going to talk about would be covered by our Tremors episode. Go back and watch the Tremors. Yeah. Go back and listen to the Tremors episode. It's when we finally got good. It's a really good episode. It's a fun movie, too.
Great movies.
But I do think this is kind of like another cephalopod, mainly because of that beak and like the kind of the tentacles that shoots out like mandibles, mouthpieces.
Which you only see in the remastered editions when George Lucas is adding all the CGI to the old movies.
What do you only see?
The beak in Sarlacc. I think you just see tentacles in the originals.
Really? Okay, that's interesting.
If I remember correctly, you never see what it actually looks like. You just see this hole that has some teeth on it and some tentacle, the tentacle that grabs Boba Fett and drags him in.
Oh, so you just saw the pit with like the spikes going down initially.
Yep.
Huh, okay. Well, yeah. Okay, well, that makes less sense now. But look, the beak looked very cephalopod-like. And I always imagined it as like this kind of... Well, not always imagined it. When I say always imagined it, ever since I've been imagining it, which is from about, you know, 3 days ago when we decided to do this episode. But, like kind of a sand-based bivalve. So you have a lot of species that will go down attached to the seafloor or, you know, something in the seafloor, bury themselves in there, and then, you know, they'll filter feed or grab stuff from the surface. So maybe that's what you've got going on here. Movement through the sand could be facilitated by the same sort of stuff that Dave was talking about in Trevor's. But then, you know, at a certain point in life, it attaches because you would think that this is a sedentary being. Unless it's like, you know, really smart and it's coming back to the same area because it knows it gets fed there by people or whatever.
It would have to be sedentary. That thing, it's too big.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not going to be, it's not efficient for that to be moving around.
No, yeah.
But it could also be a larval stage. You have the antlion, which builds burrows that are similar to this, that are kind of traps, that forms these little cones that are impossible for prey to escape from, and they just fall into the pit, and it gets to eat it.
Okay.
And then once it's an adult, it flies around.
Okay. Yeah, I mean...
But whenever you see these, and there's a really good example of it in one of the Planet Earth, the Blue Planet documentary series, it's like a series of pits all next to each other, because it makes sense that eggs that hatch near each other are going to stay in relatively the same area.
Wouldn't they want to disperse around so they can avoid competition?
You would.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a limitation of how far you can move.
Yeah. Now, this thing's going to be going after quite large prey by the size of the mouth and the pit and all that sort of stuff. So there have to be species out there on a regular basis. You know,
it has to be near a migration route of some kind.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And I mean, if that's the case, then potentially, yeah, if it's not eating that much, if it's got really slow metabolism, it could be metabolizing things over a much longer period of time. Probably still not 1,000 years, but yeah.
It could be a plant. kind of the tentacles moving around as quickly as they do makes it really hard to imagine that it's actually a plant. But there are carnivorous plants on our planet, at least that exist. And if this is going to be getting most of its energy from sunlight and could also just occasionally eat animal protein when it got the chance, I could see that.
Yeah, could happen. Like I said, the tentacles and the beak make it kind of unlikely. But if it was just the opening in the ground. I mean, that's a bit like Rafflesia, I guess. Those enormous plants that smell like meat and rely on dead flies falling in there.
The corpse flower.
The corpse flower, yeah. Smell like rotting meat, I should say. I really want to see one of them one day. Dispersal, like I said, is it just by parthenogenesis? Does it have a different life stage? There are options there. I actually don't think that this is... And this is what I like about Star Wars. Like, the creatures are somewhat... There's explanations for them. Apart from the whole,
somewhat, but I think this is one of the ones where it really falls apart, because for a sedentary organism like that, the only way that they can reproduce effectively is to either have another organism that they're mutualist with that can move the stuff around, or they're going to be marine or aquatic, so that they can just release their eggs into the water column and they get moved around by currents or by the waves themselves.
And so you don't think that they could have a mobile, early stage where they, tunnel through the sound at that stage of their lives?
I don't see it. This doesn't seem right.
Fair enough, yeah.
I don't see this thing just laying eggs. It would have to just... Every sessile organism that I know about that looks anything like this just releases eggs, and they just hatch somewhere. Yeah. Or they hatch in the water, and they eventually then land somewhere, and then that's where they're going to live now.
Yeah. No, I definitely can't think of any sort of terrestrial function this would have.
Maybe they think that the Sarlacc is eating things, but what it's actually doing is just coating them in eggs, and it lets them go, and they just move around.
Oh, yeah.
And those eggs drop off somewhere.
Could be, yeah.
Guys! Hello. Guys, it's me, the Sarlacc Pit.
Hi?
Hi. Yeah, look, don't mean to be a prick, but you two guys have got to get the out of here.
Anyway, okay, so short episode this week. Everyone, thanks for listening in. We will see you next time for hopefully another Star Wars feature, but we're not 100% sure.
That's the plan. The wrap up after the Mandalorian's over.
Yep. Adam, do you want to sign us off?
As we always say, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
See you guys. Bye.
20th Century Fox and George Lucas bring you an adventure unlike anything on your planet.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Good luck. Hit the accelerator.
Star Wars. A billion years in the making. The Force will be with you. Always.